From the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, current events, and issues that matter to you. I'm your host, Roger McDonough. Today on the program, we feature part two of our conversation with David Abrams of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health about e-cigarettes and their regulation in America. Today, in particular, we'll be looking at new FDA guidelines aimed at, among other things, preventing minors from becoming addicted to nicotine.
And we would hope that almost all of society, including those that make money out of selling these products, would agree that they shouldn't be sold to kids, that they shouldn't be marketed or advertised to kids, and that they shouldn't have attractive candy flavors.
That conversation and your summary of the day's top local headlines just ahead on The Rundown here on KCPW. And thanks again for tuning into The Rundown this afternoon. Coming up a little bit later on the show, we have part two of our look at e-cigarettes and their regulation in the United States. But first up, we have these headlines. New government figures show Utah enrollment in health care plans on the federal website greatly exceeded what the Obama administration expected. Numbers released Thursday show that 84,600 people enrolled by the March 31st deadline. That's a 48% increase from the administration's target of 57,000 for the state. The figures indicate that there was a huge surge in the final month, with more than half of the enrollees in Utah signing up in March. Enrollment started slow last fall on an online marketplace plagued by glitches, but it gradually increased with each month. Utah is one of more than 30 states that left it to the federal government to run its online exchange for individuals to find coverage. The state runs its own exchange for small businesses. The Salt Lake County government is teaming up with local municipalities to boost homeless services in the county. On Thursday, area officials announced the first disbursement of a new $200,000 grant designed to fund an anti-homelessness initiative. The money will help local organizations collaborate better in aiding Salt Lake County's homeless population. KCPW's Ryan Cunningham has more.
When homelessness in Utah comes to mind, there are a lot of tired stereotypes. Midvale Mayor Joanne Seguini has heard a lot of them, and she says the true face of homelessness is more diverse than residents might realize. In fact, because of recent economic events, much of the homeless population in Midvale is simply families who lost their houses.
We will have 300 children and less than 100 adults at our homeless shelter at any time. There are lots of kids who need protection from the weather, who need to be able to go to a school, who need to have a place that's safe. And so we're serving many, many children in our shelter.
The ever-changing demographics of the homeless population is one reason why Salt Lake area officials have agreed to band together to address the issue of homelessness. That cooperation begins on Thursday with the first payout of the Salt Lake County Council of Governments Homeless Services Grant. That grant will eventually inject $200,000 into programs around the county aimed at alleviating problems related to homelessness. Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams says it's important for communities in the county to collaborate on the issue, adding there are no clear boundaries or city lines when it comes to homelessness.
You know, when a community like Cottonwood Heights appropriates money to solve homelessness, there's not a lot of homeless people in Cottonwood Heights. When a family or an individual in Cottonwood Heights becomes homeless, they would go to Midvale or Salt Lake City. So it's easy to pass the buck and say, not our problem, you guys deal with it. But what we saw is municipalities stepping forward and saying, it may not be a problem that is evident in my community, but we are contributing to the homeless population, and they wanted to contribute financially to the solution.
The new initiative will help various homeless service providers broaden their reach. 4th Street Clinic CEO Christy Chambers says the plan will help in part by centralizing a handful of organizations at a new headquarters next to the clinic.
It allows us to really collaborate more so with Volunteers of America and Road Home. So if anything, it kind of cuts back on our meetings together, I think. By putting all of the outreach in one place, it allows us to coordinate that on so many levels. So for instance, we have a medical outreach team currently that works with VOA, but VOA is located miles away. Bringing them all together is going to, I think, simplify all of our lives.
10 communities, as well as unincorporated Salt Lake County, are participating in the Homeless Services Grant. Notable non-participants include West Valley City, West Jordan, and Taylorsville. Those cities account for almost 30% of Salt Lake County's population. For KCPW News, I'm Ryan Cunningham.
And that does it for our summary of the day's local headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. You're tuned into The Rundown. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Now on the program, we turn to part two of our conversation with Dr. David Abrams, executive director of the Schroeder Institute for Tobacco Research and Policy Studies at Legacy and professor at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. The topic of our discussion, the evolving world of e-cigarettes, their regulation and use, and what effect they have on public health in America. Dr. Abrams, where we left off yesterday, we had just started discussing some of the effects of the lack of FDA regulation on e-cigarettes, things like marketing and labeling, access to minors. These are currently ungoverned from the federal level. And I was going to ask, can you tell me a little bit about the FDA's attempts to regulate e-cigarettes, you know, first as a drug delivery device and now as a tobacco product? Can we lay out kind of a timeline of what they've tried to do and how far they've come?
Sure. Well, initially, when e-cigarettes first came on the market, FDA moved to regulate them as a therapeutic device or a delivery system of a drug. And that was through the branch that usually regulates pharmaceuticals and medical devices. Hmm. The e-cigarette companies challenged that, and a court ruling said that they were actually a tobacco product and could be marketed as a tobacco product without making any therapeutic claims as a cessation aid or a drug delivery device. So in effect, the FDA was blocked by the courts from exercising its authority initially to regulate them as a drug delivery device or for therapeutic purposes to help people quit smoking. And that left them in a regulatory no man's land literally until last week, when the FDA was given at least the beginnings of the opportunity to regulate them as a tobacco product.
So that's is that the reason for the long delay from the FDA? Is because of that lawsuit from 2010? I mean, is that the reason that it's taken as long as it has for the FDA to come out with its first regulations on e-cigarettes?
I think that's part of the explanation. Also, we do feel that it took longer than it needed to. And that, you know, it's somewhat puzzling that not only the FDA, but the FDA, when it issues a deeming regulation or rule, it has to be approved by the Office of Management and Budget. So that it's really other parts of the government bureaucracy that delayed for many, many months the FDA's application to get authority over this as a tobacco product.
So what are these new regulations that the FDA is proposing to regulate this as a tobacco product? What will that entail?
Well, firstly, they have acted immediately once these rules take effect to ban the sale to minors under 18 years of age. And I think that's long overdue. And we know some states have already done this, but this will accelerate the process of ensuring that the entire country, both on the internet and in convenience stores, are not allowed to sell any of these nicotine-containing products to people under 18 years of age.
You said immediate effect. How immediate is that? Is that now or soon?
I think they still have to go through the 75-day commentary period. Okay. And then I believe another 30 days after that would be the earliest that the ban on sales to minors could take effect. But it's going to be reasonably rapid. And in our opinion, you know, that's long overdue because we definitely don't want to sell any nicotine-containing products in any shape or form to anybody under 18 years of age.
What generally are your thoughts about these new regulations, assuming that they're okayed after the 75-day comment period, as you said? Are they doing what they should be doing, for example?
I think we're very encouraged that this is what we'd call a first step towards comprehensive regulation. There are many more rules that they will issue or have to issue in the coming years, and we hope they will prioritize them to be sure that kids are protected first and foremost. So we're really eager to see them move from these first steps to looking seriously at candy flavors, for example, and at marketing that predominantly targets youth, and beginning to promulgate rules and collect the information to allow those restrictions to be a top priority.
Can we talk for just a second about the difference in regulation between regular cigarettes and other tobacco products like cigars and pipe tobacco, for example, there's a difference in the way that they're regulated, correct?
That's correct. Some forms of burning nicotine, like hookah tobacco, as well as little cigars, cigarillos, and large premium cigars, have been exempt up until now from FDA rules because cigars are defined as a different product and do not come under the language of the Tobacco Control Act that gave FDA regulation over cigarettes and smokeless tobacco. So up until now, they have not had the authority to regulate particularly little cigars and cigarillos, which are sold singly or in small packs and also have flavors, as well as hookah tobacco. And all of those products are dramatically attractive to youth. And we've seen an uptick in youth purchases of little cigars, cigarillos, and hookah, which is also of great concern because these products are far more lethal and far more addictive than e-cigarettes.
Can I ask about those products, including hookah tobacco, cigarillos, little cigars, etc.? Are they available for purchase for people under, say, 18 years of age?
Well, it really varies. They're not supposed to be sold to anyone under 18 in any convenience stores. But of course, that has to do with both enforcement and, you know, successful prosecution of people who do not check IDs and make sure that they don't sell them to kids under 18.
Right. Okay. So now these products, cigars, pipe tobacco, cigarillos, hookah tobacco, they will be regulated along with e-cigarettes under the new regulations that the FDA has unveiled.
Well, that's a little unclear. In the 75-day commentary period, the FDA has suggested that people comment on whether they should regulate premium cigars along with little cigars and cigarillos and hookah all in one category, or whether they might only regulate some of those products. So I think it's going to depend on the comments and the FDA review, whether they comprehensively include all of the cigar products or might only include a subset of them. And probably if that's the case, premium cigars are the one that seems to be a candidate for exemption from regulation.
Do you foresee future lawsuits based on either from those industries or from those particular industries, that is, based on the attempts to regulate them?
You know, I anticipate, and FDA gets this a lot, that there probably will be some lawsuits, you know, at some point on some aspects of the rulemaking that they're going to try to implement. Maybe not in these first steps, which are pretty basic. And we would hope that almost all of society, including those that make money out of selling these products, would agree that they shouldn't be sold to kids, that they shouldn't be marketed or advertised to kids, mm-hmm. and that they shouldn't have attractive candy flavors. And we would hope that, in fact, people would self-regulate before the FDA even has to do anything. But I suspect because the profit motive comes above protecting people's lives for some companies, that they will sue for the right and the freedom to make money and challenge some of these rules.
Dr. Abrams, I'm curious, too, how other similar products, of course, they don't have, you know, candy flavors, but if you look at, for example, nicotine patches, when they hit the shelves, did they need FDA approval first? Or, I mean, they're a replacement device, right? Or
absolutely. All of them were marketed and made as a therapeutic aid to quit smoking. And therefore, they were treated like any pharmacologic new drug and had to go to very strict clinical trials and document safety and efficacy in a very rigid way to protect the public health. They were then approved by the FDA through the Drugs and Devices branch, not the Center for Tobacco Products. And eventually, they were shown to be safe and efficacious. In other words, they worked and helped people quit. And once that was established, FDA entertained applications to allow them to be sold over the counter. And so, you know, in the mid-1990s, all of these products that were deemed safe and effective were allowed to go over the counter because they aren't very addictive and you can use them to help you quit smoking.
How are other government agencies treating e-cigarettes? We looked at the Department of Transportation, for example, banning them from commercial aircraft. How are these agencies treating e-cigarettes?
I believe, again, it's variable. Some are acting fairly quickly to say that we should prevent them from being used in public places or indoors. Some states and local authorities are acting aggressively to do that. For example, we know New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago have implemented restrictions in both public places and indoors that are fairly similar to the restrictions on smoking combusted cigarettes. And so there's quite a lot of variability. And we hope that, you know, FDA regulations will then provide some standards and some consistency that would allow, again, prudent regulation that would both promote how they could be used to help people quit or to switch completely, as well as minimize the possible harms and unintended consequences, and find the right balance between too much regulation and no regulation.
But right now, that regulation is highly variable across, I mean, from state to state, community to community. I'm wondering how many states and cities, et cetera, if you know, have put age restrictions on e-cigarette either use or sales.
I believe that's up to the mid-30s now. So over 34 or 35 states now have that in place, age limits.
On the purchase and or use of e-cigarettes?
Mostly on the purchase, restricting the 18 age. Some of the restrictions on use, like indoor air, are much more variable and have been done, you know, by cities or counties rather than across the board among states.
You know, it's interesting that they're going to be regulated as essentially tobacco products when they don't have tobacco in them. I mean, they may have tobacco flavoring in them, some of them, for example. But do you see this as a potential net benefit for public health or, I don't know, or not?
Yeah, no, that's the $64,000 question, actually. And I think the answer is, I'm cautiously optimistic, but the jury is out because we really don't have enough data or experience to see how to maximize the public health good while minimizing some of the unintended harms that we talked about, like kids being more attracted to them, as well as undermining clean indoor air laws, which could delay cessation and allow people to use both products, thinking that they're reducing their harm, but not really quitting the much more lethal combusted cigarette. So there are definitely some downsides, but overall, this could be the biggest opportunity in a century to make the combusted cigarette obsolete, because as you just said, we know it kills half the people who use it prematurely. And frankly, it's a defective product because of that. So we see no reason why, now that we have safer forms of delivering nicotine, why we couldn't even ask the big tobacco companies, like we asked GM, to remove defective cars from the market when their ignitions fail. They should remove defective products. And why don't they make their money with less defective products that help people and reduce the almost 500,000 preventable deaths per year from combusted cigarettes?
Well, and but there is, as you said, there is still that risk that in the meantime, people are using them as kind of a bridge to get them through the day before they go back to that very lethal cigarette.
Yeah, and we couldn't strongly recommend more strongly that people should, if they do dual use, it should be along the pathway to eventually quitting smoking cigarettes and or quitting everything. So I think dual use is okay for a little while as you're weaning yourself off the more lethal combusted cigarette. But at some point, you should be switching completely and then trying to quit everything.
Dr. Abrams, you talked about the lack of data that is out there. Is that data forthcoming? Do we have research pending that will help illuminate or shed some light on all of this?
We do, but it's sort of a catch-22. I think, you know, FDA also has to educate the public to aggressively see how much we can get people to quit smoking cigarettes and persuade them aggressively to switch exclusively to these much safer forms of nicotine if they can't quit. And so, you know, it's a bit of a catch-22. I think for a few years, even though we're collecting the data, we're not going to see dramatic changes in patterns in either direction. Mm-hmm. And what we may see is people, you know, like the blind people and the elephant focusing on just one aspect. If we see more kids using them, we may become overly restrictive before we've given them a chance to show the benefits for adults. So I think we don't want to take premature action without the data. On the other hand, we don't want to wait too long until the damage is done. So this is a very important area to be very vigilant, to collect the data aggressively, and to try to make prudent public health decisions as quickly as possible, but without knee-jerk reactions that eventually may do more harm than good.
Dr. David Abrams, Executive Director of the Schroeder Institute for Tobacco Research and Policy Studies at Legacy and of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Thanks very much for sharing this with us today.
Thank you. You're welcome.
And after finishing up our conversation with Dr. Abrams, we reached out to the Food and Drug Administration to clarify some questions we had about how the FDA is regulating e-cigarettes and why the regulatory process takes as long as it does. Yesterday, I spoke with Mitch Zeller, director of the FDA's Center for Tobacco Products. Here's some of that conversation. Mr. Zeller, in 2009, the FDA conducted limited laboratory studies and found significant quality issues with e-cigarettes, and the American Lung Association urged at the time quick action to halt the sale of e-cigarettes unless they had FDA approval. Why wasn't action taken then in terms of regulation, and why are they still not regulated?
Well, we actually did take action in 2009. We took enforcement action against e-cigarettes at the time, declaring them to be unapproved drugs and devices. And as soon as we took that enforcement action, the agency was sued by one of the importers, and we wound up in 2 years of litigation in courts. And the courts ultimately ruled that unless an e-cigarette makes a therapeutic or treatment claim, like helps you quit smoking, the only way that FDA could regulate e-cigarettes was under the new tobacco authorities. And that litigation wasn't completed, and the government didn't announce its decision to acquiesce to those court rulings until the spring of 2011. But the short answer is, in 2009, we did act. We acted in the most direct way, and that is with enforcement action, and we wound up being sued and we lost.
Hey, you know what that makes me wonder is it in the best interest then of these of e-cigarette makers to not claim to be a cessation device?
That's a question for them, not for the regulator. The depending upon the claim that the company wants to make, if they choose to go the cessation route, even the courts that ruled against FDA in that enforcement case concluded that a cessation claim means that it should be regulated by FDA as either a drug or a device under the safety and efficacy standard. What we have been working on over the last few years was to get out the proposed rule that was issued last week to create the regulatory framework to regulate e-cigarettes under the tobacco authorities in the absence of a cessation claim.
Is this process slower than normal when it comes to providing a regulatory framework, when you talk about rulemaking by the FDA for an industry?
Rulemakings in general do take time because when they go final, they have the force of law. And a company that violates an enforceable final rule is at risk for civil and sometimes even criminal actions for violating a legally enforceable regulation. So in order to create those kinds of regulations, because the stakes are so high, we take our time to get it right. And this is the first step in the process. What was published last week is a proposed rule. And as you said, there's a 75-day comment period, and we are interested in hearing from all parties, all sectors, on every aspect of the proposed deeming rule, from the compliance policy that we are proposing to the warning labels. There's a number of very important issues for interested parties to address, and we will read and consider each and every comment that comes in.
All right, Mitch Zeller, director of the FDA's Center for Tobacco Products, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
And that concludes our two-part look at e-cigarettes here on The Rundown. You can find both segments as well as all of our past interviews at our website, kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're listening to The Rundown. We'll be right back. And thanks again for tuning into The Rundown this afternoon. The show is produced by Lauren Colucci. We had additional help today from Jesse Ellis, Mr. Tyler Ford, and news intern Max McLeod. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Tomorrow on the program, why do some rape kits at the Salt Lake City Police Department go unprocessed? We'll speak with Police Chief Chris Burbank to get the answer. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are coming up next.